Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from Washington, D.C., and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Shannon O'Neill discuss NAFTA at its 20th anniversary. Dr. O'Neill is CFR's Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies, and she recently served as the Director of the CFR-sponsored Independent Task Force on North America. Previously, Dr. O'Neill was a Fulbright Scholar, a Justice, Welfare, and Economics Fellow at Harvard University, and she taught Latin America politics at Columbia University. She's testified before Congress and is a frequent commentator on major television and radio programs. Her work has been published in Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, Washington Post, just to name a few. Dr. O'Neill is the author of Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead. This is her latest book, and it is now available in paperback. You can also follow her on Twitter at Shannon K. O'Neill. Shannon, thanks very much for being with us today. As I mentioned, you were the project director for the CFR Independent Task Force on North America that was co-chaired by Robert Zoellick and General David Petraeus. I know that the task force touched on many things, and you can pick out what you'd like to cover, but it would be great if you could talk about the role NAFTA has played in the region as we are sitting at the 20th anniversary, and offer policy recommendations that you and the task force came up with and how we think about the integration of North America.
Great. Well, thank you, Irina. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. And let me start. I'll start talking a bit about NAFTA and really giving an overview. As we now have reached 20 years of this free trade agreement, what's been good, what's been bad, what's been indeterminate, and then as we open it up to your questions and comments from all that are listening on here, we can talk about some of the other issues as well facing North America that might interest you. So let's talk about NAFTA. On the whole, NAFTA has been a net good for the three countries, for the United States, for Canada, and for Mexico, the three participants. If you look at the trade and the sheer amounts going back and forth, in the year before NAFTA, it was less than $300 billion between the three neighbors, and today it is near $1.2 trillion, so well over $1 trillion. It's almost a fourfold increase that we've seen between these three countries. And for the United States in particular, our two neighbors are really our two most important export markets. So one-third of all U.S. exports go to its neighbors. And when you look at it compared to other big traders that you think about, particularly, say, China, the United States exports five times the amount to Mexico or to Canada as it does to China. So we've really seen a shift with NAFTA, pushed by NAFTA, as well as some other changes, to exponentially increase the amount of trade between the three nations. Another big shift is not just the amount of trade, which is impressive, but it's the type of trade. And so we've seen a shift over these 20 years from exporting finished goods to each other or oil, other natural resources, to the movement of pieces and parts. And this attests to or illustrates the real creation of regional supply chains in the way things are made now. And one sort of telling statistic in getting at this is that for every import from Mexico, so things that we think about that are quote-unquote made in Mexico, on average of the value added of that product, 40% of it was actually made in the United States by U.S. workers, by U.S. companies. And looking at Canada, the number is 25%. So everything that comes in from Canada, 25% of that product was actually made in the United States by U.S. workers. And that relationship we have with our two neighbors is unique compared to any other relationship we have around the world in terms of trade. So you look at China, you look at Brazil, you look even at the European Union, less than 4% of the value added of the products that come in from all of those different nations were made in the United States. So we have a very different relationship in terms of trade, in terms of actually the way production works today, in large part because of NAFTA. Another issue, so one is trade, the amount and the type of trade. Another issue that has changed in these 20 years is foreign direct investment. And this treaty, the free trade agreement, in many ways is also an investment treaty. And so we've seen foreign direct investment escalate to the point that there's been over $1 trillion worth of money invested in these three countries by the various neighbors. So most of it has been the United States investing in Canada and investing in Mexico. But we've also seen good flows of Canadian money in the United States and even more recently Mexican money coming to the United States. So part of this joint production that's starting to happen has meant a lot of movement of capital back and forth, investing in these three countries as a region. Another beneficiary of NAFTA in these 20 years has been consumers. And so the prices of goods have come down in many different areas. In fact, some estimates that have been done for the United States is that the average U.S. household saves almost $1,000 a year in goods and services because of NAFTA. We've also seen some of the quality go up in different things. So whether it's cars or computers or produce that you can find in January and not just in July, those too have benefited consumers all around. Now, despite many of these benefits, the increase in trade, the increase in investment, the lower prices for consumers, NAFTA, if you've opened a newspaper, if you looked at the midterm elections and the like, you would see that it's not viewed favorably, particularly in the United States. So over half of people in the United States, when they're asked about NAFTA, see it negatively. Lesser numbers in Canada and Mexico, but still about a fourth of Mexicans and about 35-36% of Canadians are skeptical of the benefits of NAFTA. And so this is a real question, right? Given that there were these benefits, why do we see the skepticism? You know, I would say, in part, one of the reasons is the uneven benefits of this free-to-trade agreement, and like many free-to-trade agreements. In these types of changes, there are always winners and losers. And so while overall the benefits have outweighed the negatives, that doesn't mean that particular pockets, particular places haven't suffered disproportionately from what happens when you open up your markets. And so some factories have left, even as others have been able to stay or have even expanded because of access to these new markets. Now, overall, when you look at economic studies, the net jobs have been either basically flat, zero, no net loss or gain, or slightly positive for the United States. But it's much easier to identify the factory that left and went to Mexico or went to Canada than the one that stayed or the one that formed a new factory precisely because of this joint production that's happening across boundaries. Another reason I think we see a negative perception of NAFTA in many parts or in many places is that NAFTA happened when lots of other changes were happening in the United States. And so it's become part of these larger debates and even sort of a touchstone or a key word for these larger changes that are happening. And then during a year of 20 years when we've seen wage stagnation for many parts of the socioeconomic ladder, where we've seen increasing inequality. Now, there's lots of things that go into this. There's technology, there's changes in productivity, there's changes in education and all these things. But trade has been mixed in there. And so how you parse out the effects of all these different types of factors on the U.S. workforce is difficult to do. Economists debate how you prioritize or the weight that each of these factors are given. But I think in many ways, NAFTA's become this touchstone for those that worry about these issues, but also worry about the role of trade vis-a-vis these other types of factors. And then finally, I'd say one last thing is that there was, at the time, an overselling of NAFTA. And so you look back at the debates at the time and, you know, people, Bill Clinton, when he was trying to get it through Congress, promised that it was going to stop immigration into the United States, that it was going to lead to this huge job growth, that it was going to really change our economy. And some of those promises were too much for one free trade agreement, even one that was at the time the most ambitious that the United States had embarked on. So many of the things that we care about or that we think about as well with our relationships with our neighbors, whether it is energy reform and opening up the energy sector and connecting it, which is something we talked a lot about in the task force, whether it's the movement of people, those were left out of this free trade agreement, so weren't going to actually touch on or change those for the better or for the worse. these are, as we think about now being at the 20th anniversary, is where we should go next. And so while it's been a net benefit for the United States, the agreement is now 20 years old. There's been lots of updates in the way we think about free trade around the world, and there's been a lot of changes in our relationship with our neighbors precisely because of the integration that NAFTA helped spur. And so as I open this up for your questions, let me just leave it as that NAFTA, in my view, has been a net benefit for the United States, for Mexico, and for Canada. But it's time now to think about what we should be doing together as three nations to increase and to really augment the benefits for the coming 20 years. Thank you.
Shannon?
Yes.
That was great. Thank you very much. Now let's open it up to questions and comments from the students.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And our first question comes from Norwich University.
Yes, thank you very much. It was very informative. I see the recommendations that Carla Hills in Foreign Affairs wrote down in her article, and one of them says go to North American universities, North American universities, think tanks, and business organizations should educate people about the benefits of NAFTA, otherwise the people won't support it. Do you think that's something that would benefit the three states?
You know, I do think that NAFTA has not been thought about in a balanced way, particularly in the United States. I think both Mexico and Canada have a bit more of a broader perspective. But here we see very little talk about it. And in fact, when we do see talk, sometimes it's misinformed, if not incorrect. And let me give you an example of this. Last year, in the State of the Union address that President Obama gave, there was one reference to Mexico in the whole speech. And that reference was when President Obama said that Ford Motors, Ford cars, had brought jobs back from Mexico to the United States. So they had brought them back, as if this was a zero-sum game. And, you know, by saying that, and there was lots of clapping after, as there is in the State of the Union every time, the problem is that that's actually factually incorrect. Over the last few years, in Mexico, Ford has actually opened new plants and expanded their plants. But by doing so in Mexico and locating part of the production in Mexico, they were also able to expand plants in the United States and increase jobs in the United States. And so it is true that Ford has created new jobs in the United States and expanded their workforce in the United States. But it's not because they brought the jobs back from Mexico. It's precisely because they increased their workforce in Mexico that they made different parts of the car. They worked on both sides of the border that they're able to make a more competitive car that could be sold in the United States, that could be sold to Mexican consumers, which are growing rapidly, or that could be sold around the world. And so I think that understanding of actually how NAFTA or how this regional integration actually helps jobs on both sides of the border, and frankly, how dependent we are, even though we rarely realize it, in many industries, in many companies, in many sectors, your ability to keep your job, your ability to be productive and produce a good product will depend on the productivity and education and skills of people on a different side of the border, whether in Canada or in Mexico. And I think that is something that we could teach better in our universities, in our classrooms, in our discussions with the media and others. And I think that would at least provide a bit of a better balance about what's the good and the bad for particular types of people, for particular types of industries or jobs or sectors, are from whether it's NAFTA or other free trade agreements, because we're moving into a world that is inherently going to be a global world. And so how we think best to prepare ourselves, our students, our workers, and everyone else for that world so we get more of the benefits is a real discussion I think we should all be having.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lehman College.
Hi, Shannon. It's Alicia Galvez. Thanks for your presentation. I had a question for you. One is, I have more than one, but I think I'll just ask one because it's all will be allowed. My question is, how if you had to be a fortune teller and looking to, you know, some fictional moment where NAFTA was being renegotiated, do you think it would be as important to Mexico to include migration? I know migration was not included for political reasons the first time, but do you think that the next time it would not be considered as important from the Mexican viewpoint?
You mean if you were to redo 20 years ago, what happened, or going forward for today?
No, going forward, because, you know, there's always talk of perhaps renegotiating NAFTA or update, you know, a NAFTA 2.0.
Sure.
And I think that migration not being included was one of the regrets of some of the Mexican principals who were at the table. But I'm just curious whether you think they would insist on it being included now or if it's ceased to be as central to their vision of Mexico's prosperity.
You know, I think if you think about updating NAFTA, right now the United States, Canada, and Mexico in many ways are doing that through the negotiation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. So they're working with several other nations, Pacific nations, as well as some other Latin American nations, Chile, Peru, and not yet Colombia, but Chile and Peru. So I think there is a renegotiation happening now of the free trade agreement. And there again, we've seen left off the table the movement of labor. You know, I think there's two ways to think about this. In the U.S.-Mexico relationship, I think the renegotiation of the movement of labor is vital. And in part, it's because there's so many deep ties, there's so many families and communities and now workforces, as I was mentioning, that straddle the border. And so how do we make that more efficient and more humane, frankly? But trying to take those issues and put them into a free trade agreement framework also doesn't make a lot of sense to me. These are issues that are in the bilateral relationship, which is much larger than investments or company production ties across borders or even sales of exports and imports. So I do think they're quite important. In fact, the same thing with even some areas that are more obviously economically focused, such as energy. There are reasons to have openness, but I think there's reasons for the three nations, Canada, Mexico, and the United States, to think about, and we talk about this in the task force, to think about integrating their energy matrices, integrating their electricity grids, integrating their pipeline systems and the like to make sure for all three countries and then for the industry and the consumers and the families and households in all three countries that they have reliable and affordable electricity, gas, energy more broadly. But whether that should be included in a free trade agreement as such or whether that's a different type of agreement that, you know, government support than private sector investment in, I would actually, personally, I would keep some of those separate because it's about the broader relationship, but it's not about these particular trade arrangements. And if you expand them to include so many different aspects, then I think it's very hard to get anything done at all, right? You're already seeing challenges in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in the various players protecting various aspects of their economies or their tariffs or other types of quotas that they have. Imagine if all of a sudden you were also adding into that debate the movement of people or other types of bilateral issues. I think it would get very difficult to make any headway on any of them.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from St. Edward's University.
Hi, my name is Shannon Noel, and I just want to thank you for your presentation. Just kind of going off reviewing NAFTA and maybe making any kind of changes, and what you said about President Obama's foreign focus is one thing that I think would be created NAFTA to facilitate trade, and cartels, obviously, Mexican drug cartels disrupt that trade, especially in border areas as well as in Quitadores. Do you find it interesting that in our foreign policy and our foreign news, we're more focused on ISIS and Ebola, which have much less direct effect on the American consumer than NAFTA, and what do you think we'll have to do if NAFTA is to be modernized and made more relevant to get past this kind of broad focus and not something that's close to home, even though we have, as you said, a third of our exports are to our neighbors?
You know, in working on this task force, that was really one of the central themes and reasons for doing it and for bringing in people such as Robert Zoellick and David Petraeus, who are not known for their focus on Mexico or Canada. They're much more global thinkers, or you know, Petraeus was known for his service in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And so part of the challenge is this: why, given the importance of these countries to our economy, to our neighborhood, and all the other ties we have, why do we think so little about them? And I would say there's sort of two reasons. One is, for various reasons, U.S. foreign policy often tends to be more reactive than proactive. And so there's fires all over the world, there's crises happening in Syria or in Iran or in Iraq or Afghanistan or numerous other places, and so those draw the attention of cabinet ministers, of the president, of the vice president, and others, because they're so immediate. And this comes down to the second reason, is that we are much better. We're reactive rather than proactive. And we're often much more likely to focus on the urgent and not the important. And so the benefit of North America is that actually things are going quite well. And despite the fact that we are not focusing on these countries, they're not focusing on our back and forth between our neighbors, the private sector, families, communities, nonprofit organizations, civil society more broadly, there's a lot of interactions that are happening, and many of them quite good. Now, of course, there are challenges, and you bring up the cartels, and that's obviously a challenge on the southern border. There's also been worries and challenges on the northern border in terms of worries about nefarious characters coming into the United States or going back over into Canada. So it's not that there are not tensions in these relationships, but they're moving along quite well. And so if you only have so much bandwidth in the White House, in the Situation Room, Mexico and Canada rarely show up in the Situation Room, which means they often get forgotten. But as you began your question with, and I agree with this, is that if you think forward 20 years, what relationships are going to be the most important for the United States in terms of standard of living here for people, in terms of economic growth, in terms of influence around the world? And I would argue that our relationship with our neighbor and neighbors and how we develop it or not will really decide some of that global influence and general standard of living and wealth here domestically.
Right. And you know, we've had maybe 2,000, 3,000 ISIS-related deaths in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've had 16,000 deaths from Mexican drug cartels in 2013 alone. And so what do you think we'll have to do to actually get the focus to modernize NAFTA back on a local level, which is, you know, when obviously beheading a journalist is horrific, but Mexican drug cartels are known for killing women and children specifically to make a point. What do you think will have to happen in the White House and then on a local level to get a focus back on stuff that's a little bit closer to home?
Well, Mexico's insecurity challenges are broader than drug cartels. And many of the difficulties they've been facing, and particularly some of those in the recent weeks that have become quite volatile in Mexico and in the papers, and there was a march yesterday where hundreds of thousands of people marched, are really about a quite weak rule of law, and particularly in certain areas of Mexico, the lack of a democratic rule of law. And so whether that is drug cartels, whether that's bandits, whether that is actually penetrated local officials, as in the case, it seems, of the state of Guerrero, in this town in Guerrero, the challenge is how do you create a real strong democratic rule of law? And there in Mexico, there's a lot of steps it needs to take. It's not going to be any fast fix. Some it's starting to take, though I would argue perhaps more slowly than it needs to. It's transforming its justice system, which does not function. I mean, the chances of you commit a crime, the chances of you being tried and convicted are very low, so there's really no legal deterrent to crime. The ability to reform police forces, they have well over 2,000 police forces throughout the country, federal, state, local police forces. Some work with some competence. Many work with no competence at all or ability. Many, again, are infiltrated by criminals of all types. So how do you professionalize those? And there I think there's a role for the United States to help play. We do have security arrangements. We are working more closely together than we were, say, 8 or 10 years ago. But it's a learning process. And in the end, this particular issue that you're bringing up, it really has, in the end, it's up to the Mexicans. It's up to the Mexican government and citizens to create this rule of law, to invest in this rule of law and change the way that that country works. But I do think there's a place for the United States and Canada, by extension, to help in this. And we, you know, we in the United States have had a lot of experiences with ourselves. And, you know, it's glamorized often in Hollywood, but there were, you know, many corrupt police forces throughout the United States that Hollywood directors then picked up upon, right? There were many corrupt attorney generals and judges and even perhaps, politicians and the like. And we, through a series of legal acts, the RICO Act that allowed us to target organized crime by the creation of internal affairs groups within police forces that would root out corruption, by beginning to prosecute and convict those for wrongdoing that were found guilty, those sorts of things changed our police forces in our big cities and the like. And I think that is a path, and there's other examples around the world, but that's a path that Mexico, too, could take.
Great. Next question, please.
Thank you. The next question comes from the University of Southern California.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Dr. Neal. I got questions on Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Now, it has been concluded back in October 2014. How do you see this as something that kind of like divert renegotiation of NAFTA? Is it kind of like a threat, or is it like something that becomes a opportunity for renegotiation of NAFTA? Thank you.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, in my view, is really a way to move beyond NAFTA without reopening NAFTA, which has lots of political ramifications and is quite difficult to renegotiate something that's already there. It would, when and if it comes together, it would include many areas that were not included in NAFTA, some because they're quite difficult to include, things like government procurement laws and intellectual property. I would include some things that didn't exist in 1992 when they were negotiating NAFTA, things like e-commerce and cybersecurity, which were not there to even think about. And it would include sort of a broader mix of countries. So it would go in many ways beyond NAFTA. It is still in negotiations. There's a lot of tough negotiations to be had with the Japanese, with the United States, with Australia, with others. So there's some areas that are still quite open on the table and somewhat tense. And then I think the other big challenge is for the United States and our domestic politics. We just had our midterm elections. As you all know, the Republicans took back both houses of Congress. So we have a Republican-dominated Congress with a Democratic-dominated executive branch. And so, you know, I think the question is, one, can they work together on anything? And then if they can work together on anything, what would be the areas where we might see some bipartisan cooperation? Many have thought that trade will be that area and TPP will be that area. But you will have to get Democrats and Republicans to agree to give, most likely to agree to give the president what's often dubbed fast-track authority, so the trade promotion authority, so that the treaty that the executive branch negotiates will go to Congress and get voted thumbs up or thumbs down. So they'll decide yes or no on that treaty. They won't go and try to reopen negotiations basically in the Congress and add things to the treaty, because if you add it there, you'd have to go back to all of the participating nations and their governments and see if you could work out a deal with them. So it makes it hard to imagine how those negotiations would end. And if the United States doesn't have this trade promotion authority, it's difficult to get many of our counterparts to even come to the negotiations now to come up with a deal if they think it's going to be reopened down the road. So I think TPP is actually a quite strong and useful vehicle to further deepen opening and trade and deal with some of the other issues that were left off the table with NAFTA or were incomplete. But the success of it in the next couple of years, I think, will really depend on how we see this Congress and the President work together on this or any other issue.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Hopkins.
Good morning. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the recent sugar agreement that was signed by NAFTA, between the U.S. and Mexico. And can you just discuss a little bit about the impact of this agreement and let us know if this sugar issue is satisfying to both the U.S. and Mexico, or is this sugar going to be a continuous issue going forward?
You know, sugar has been an issue for both countries before NAFTA, after NAFTA, and up until today. So I would never want to predict that we've solved the problem and we've taken it off the table. And you know, in part, the United States has a quite restrictive quota system on sugar. We use it, one, to protect domestic industries, and then, two, also to sometimes reward allies and nations with which we're close, giving them access, being able to export to us particular quotas of sugar at the inflated prices that we pay here in the United States, in many ways to protect the domestic industry. So, you know, every time you go and buy a Coca-Cola or whatever your favorite sugary snack is, you're paying more for it, in part because of our trade policies and our policy on sugar. And so we've seen at various times Mexico, which is also a sugar producer and can produce, because of its climate, because of its geography, can produce sugar at cheaper rates than we can produce it here in the United States. NAFTA was to open up so many of these sectors, but there's still some tensions here, and that's what we've seen over the last we've seen them arise before, but we've seen them arise recently. I do think this agreement solved, at least for the moment, resolved our issues with major sugar producers in Mexico. I don't think they will, you know, go to WTO or NAFTA or others to press their case. There's been some sort of resolution there. But as crops change, as world prices change, which they undoubtedly will do in the future, it's possible that we will again have another negotiation on sugar. But for the moment, it seems we've come to an amicable arrangement between the two countries on that particular issue.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phones now. And our next question comes from Washington and Lee University.
Hi, my name is Emily Webb, and at the end of your conversation, you told us that we should be thinking about where we are, the three countries right now, and maybe where we need to be headed, what we need to change. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestions about what direction we should take.
Sure. Great, Emily. No, I mean, I think there are a lot of quite positive directions that we can take. And this is something that we talk a lot about in the task force. And in the task force, we divided the relationships, which are much more complicated than this, but just for an analytical schematic way, we divided into four basic baskets. So one was economic competitiveness. And so many of these ties, we're talking about NAFTA and tariffs and the like, what we could do to improve those ties. We talked a lot about energy. And all in every one of these countries, in all three of these countries, the energy possibilities are transforming quite rapidly. Here in the United States, over the last 7 or 8 years, we've seen this explosion of shale gas and oil. In Canada, we've seen a growth in production through in Alberta through the oil sands, the often called tar sands there. And in Mexico, they've reformed their energy sector to allow foreign direct investment, which could really transform the energy, the oil and energy industry in Mexico as well. And so that was one area we also looked at. How could we harness this bounty that seems to be coming to North America in a way that makes North America stronger? We talked also about security issues, which are going to be important because as neighbors, many of the threats that we face are mutual threats. And then finally, we had a category that we called community, which involved things like immigration and the movement of people, but also involved the back and forth and the mutual challenges of natural disasters or things like health pandemics. And so I think in all of those areas, there are things we can do. Let me just touch briefly on the economic ones, and I'm happy to talk about the other ones. And one thing that happened when NAFTA came about and we removed all the tariffs between our countries, or most of the tariffs between our countries, is it really illuminated other barriers to the back and forth, the economic back and forth between our nations. And so the differences between regulations all of a sudden became much more visible and much more important in terms of slowing trade and joint production. So some of these regulations are serious. It's differences we have in terms of the way we guard, you know, sanitary conditions or the like. But other are as trivial as the size of a label that goes onto a product. And so is there a way where we could recognize each other's various regulations or harmonize those regulations to make trade move faster and support more jobs, support more production and the like? Another big issue is infrastructure. And so as the trade between our nations increased fourfold, the investment in the border infrastructure, in the ports of entry, or, you know, the crossings between the nations, in the railroads, in the airports, in the ports, and all that are connecting our three nations, stagnated. So we see a huge increase in the usage, but not a lot of investment in expanding that. And that's led to long wait times and other real problems at the border for companies that operate on both sides. So I think there's a lot we could do on the economic competitiveness side, given that we have this integration of companies. We have factories on both sides that are employing people on both sides and making products together. How can we facilitate it so that those products can move more seamlessly and in the process compete vis-a-vis products that are made in places like China or Asia more broadly, the European Union, the rest of Latin America, or elsewhere around the world?
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Washington University.
Hi. I was wondering if you think the language in NAFTA is a little bit overly broad in that, I guess from my understanding, it's overly broad in that anything that acts as a minimal barrier to trade or reduces the maximum amount of trade, it is inconsistent with NAFTA and then not allowed. So where I'm coming from is thinking about the marches on the Mexico Capitol from little corn farmers in Mexico. It's cheaper to import corn from the United States, putting all these people out of business. How do you think that we should handle that, and what kinds of protections or I guess like trinational bodies can regulate these kinds of things so that other people are protected aside from the large corporations?
Sure. So, you know what, it's interesting because agriculture in every free trade agreement always seems to be a sticking point. And, you know, one of the reasons that the Doha round, so the, you know, world-level free trade agreements have stalled is because of agricultural protections in industrial economies. So in Europe, in the United States, and other places. And what's interesting is actually what has been the outcome of NAFTA on agriculture. Yes, the United States, we have lots of subsidies for our corn producers. We have lots of price supports and the like. We also have here in the United States a lot of very capital-intensive production of corn. So we have very few now any subsistence farmers. And in fact, you know, the number of people employed in agriculture in the United States is quite low, as we're in an economy dominated by services and then secondarily by manufacturing. If you look at Mexico's economy and the effect of NAFTA on agriculture over the last 20 years, the group that lost the most, I would say, are large corn producers, not the small corn producers, actually, but the large corn producers that have been hit hardest. Those that have benefited the most have been produce suppliers, so people who grow melons and tomatoes and other sorts of things. Those farms, on average, are smaller acreage, so smaller vegetable and produce producers have benefited from NAFTA in Mexico coming to the United States. Larger corn producers have benefited less from NAFTA. And so many of those marches, actually, and in part, larger farms are better able to organize than smaller subsistence farmers who can't take the time off to go march. Those are those people who are marching, are sort of the larger producers. But the effects there have been, like any free trade agreement, there are winners and losers. But what's interesting is in agriculture in Mexico, it's a mixed bag. Actually, smaller farmers who produce produce have benefited. Larger corn producers have probably lost out. The other interesting aspect here is during these 20 years of NAFTA, Mexico's economy has moved from one that is agricultural and commodity-based, basically oil, to one that is manufacturing and services dominated. So we've seen a fundamental shift in its economy. And when that has happened historically in any nation in the world, any European nation, the United States, Japan, name others that have made this transition, the percentage of people that are employed in agriculture falls dramatically. It's just the way things work, right? People move off the farms, they move to cities, they get jobs in manufacturing or industry or services or other sorts of things. And that, too, is what has been happening in Mexico, is that over this 20 years, we have seen the percentage of people employed in agriculture drop dramatically. We've seen the amount of corn produced in Mexico over this 20 years increase significantly. So there's a change in the way farming is happening. It's much more productive per acre in terms of the corn that's being produced. It's more capital intensive, so you see more tractors and other sorts of capital being put into farming. But I would say overall, the differences, they're much more nuanced than just corn going down to Mexico and wiping out the industry there, because actually the production of corn has increased over this 20 years, not fallen in Mexico.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Babson College.
Hello. Thank you. In regard to what you were actually speaking a few moments ago between the recent win of the Republican and having a Democrat president right now in the U.S., what's the view of the NAFTA agreement, and what do you think this will have in consequence with Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto in the pre? Do you think there's going to be a good or a bad sense of what cannot really affect the NAFTA agreement?
I mean, as I look at the divided government in the United States, there are a few things I would imagine could gain bipartisan support. Some of those things are domestic. I would imagine there's room for an agreement on a tax reform, some sort of tax reform. Not that it'll be easy, but I think there's probably room there. I could imagine that we could see an increase in infrastructure spending. There could be a win between the two parties in terms of spending on and improving basic infrastructure to the United States, which could be beneficial to U.S.-Mexico, particularly if some of that was sent to the border region. As I mentioned before, I think trade is an area where we could see some agreement. The Republican leadership and many members of the Republican Party are generally predisposed to be pro-trade, and I think there is a group within the Democratic Party, including the president and his USTR, his trade representative, that has been negotiating these agreements. So I think TPP is an area that we could potentially see some agreement and some movement forward, and that would be in line with NAFTA, but sort of moving beyond NAFTA. One area we haven't really yet touched upon, but we touch upon in the North American Task Force, and is obviously crucial for Mexico and the United States, is this area of immigration. I don't see here an easy accord between, a bipartisan accord developing. We've seen over the last couple of years different attempts at this. A bill in the Senate that passed, but not in the House and the like. I think it's going to be quite hard to pass that. But I would expect that the Obama administration would use executive orders and other bureaucratic means to change a bit the way that they've been approaching immigration. So to slow the deportations, to allow working permits to, I mean, as they've already done to the Dreamers, you know, to those that were brought here as young children. You might see an expansion for those undocumented immigrants who have very deep ties here in the United States. Perhaps they have children who are U.S. citizens who were born here, but they themselves are not authorized to be here. I think we may see some movement in the executive branch there. If the Republicans, in my view, the Republicans strategically, it would make sense for them to put immigration back on the table and work to design a reform that could pass. But I would imagine they'll focus on those other issues I mentioned, trade, tax reform, and the like, before they'll bring immigration back into the discussion.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. The next question comes from University of Puget Sound.
Hi. As you've mentioned a few times, the Republicans, and particularly even Mitch McConnell, who's likely to be the next Senate leader, I think even just yesterday said that he expects that one of the areas where the Republican Senate and Congress will be able to work with the president is on trade. What are the lessons from NAFTA, both in the negotiation as well as in the implementation, that both the Republican Congress and the president should draw as they move forward in trying to finish up some of these new and impending trade deals?
And we've had a lot of experience in the United States, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's, you know, agreements with South Korea, with Colombia, Peru, Central America. And we're also in negotiations with the Europeans right now on a trade and investment treaty across the Atlantic. I mean, I think the perhaps lesson here for the administration, and given how tense and polarized things have been in the United States, is more back and forth between Congress and the executive as they go forward in the negotiations. And that's, you know, it's difficult as Mike Froman, our trade representative, or others are sitting across the table from their counterparts. You know, it's hard to be calling back to Washington to check in with representatives within the Congress. But when you look at getting NAFTA done when it happened in the early 1990s, you know, there were key proponents or very forceful proponents for it in the executive branch, but there were also those in the Senate and the House that were involved, that were quite supportive, many from the Texas delegations, but others as well. And so I think as we move forward as the United States, as the trade representative moves forward in negotiations, whether it's on the Pacific side or the Atlantic side, keeping particular congressional leaders in the loop and finding a champion or champions within the Congress from both parties, I think would allow perhaps a smoother passage, both of TPA, so allowing the fast-track authority, right? Letting the Republicans have to trust the administration enough in the negotiations to grant the administration this up or down vote. And one way to gain that trust is to show them a bit about what's happening in the negotiations. So I think perhaps the biggest lesson from past negotiations is about process rather than actual, you know, stipulations within there. But how do you bring everybody on board? Well, you need to have some negotiations here on this soil, even as you're negotiating internationally abroad.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. The next question comes from University Bridgeport.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. O'Neill. I have my questions regarding to the TPP and NAFTA. How do these two free trade organizations affect the U.S.-China trade relations? Thank you.
Well, neither NAFTA or TPP include China, so there's no direct change there. You know, many people have felt that TPP is a response to China or a way to compete with China. And if you look at NAFTA over the last 20 years, you know, when we think about many of the jobs that have left or the factories that have left, yes, there have been some that have gone to Mexico, though, as I was mentioning with my car example, there's many more that have stayed or expanded here because of the ties back and forth. But many, if arguably, of some of the jobs or factories that have left have gone to China, with whom we do not have a free trade agreement. And so as the United States thinks about being competitive vis-a-vis the world in its production of manufactured goods and perhaps even services, having this level playing field that free trade agreements like NAFTA or TPP provide can be a good way for it to compete vis-a-vis any country, you know, China being a country, right? And the United States in general, though, as we mentioned in sugar and others, we have particular regimes or particular idiosyncrasies. But in general, we tend to be a pretty low unilateral tariffs and other barriers and compared to other countries. And so a free trade agreement that would include China, actually, if we negotiated one, I'm not talking about TPP being part of this, but let's say we were negotiating a free trade agreement with China, in many ways, it would probably benefit the United States more than it would China, because China can already send things here fairly free of a lot of tariffs or quotas or other sorts of barriers. Not in every particular category, but overall, we're a fairly open economy for everyone, and I don't think that's the case in the reverse. So what would these mean for the U.S.-China relationship? It potentially, if it strengthens regional or Pacific supply chains. It provides alternatives to many of the supply chains or the production chains that use China. It's possible. But the whole world of global trade is one that's morphing every day for lots of reasons. Free trade agreements are one, but technology is another, capital is another, education level, skills, all of those things add in together to shape where things are made. And so I think this is just, if TPP passes, if it's negotiated and then passes, it would just be one element among many that would reshape the way we produce things in the world today.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Norwich University.
Hi. Thanks, Dr. Shannon. Yes, Dr. O'Neill. I have a question based on what you expressed about a more global view by, for example, Mr. Padraeus, and the link with a more global approach. Do you think there is an opening now? Do you see openings for possibilities to expand cooperation, especially cooperation agreements with other trade commercial associations like CARICOM? On one side, the Americas, and I'm thinking about CARICOM and Mercosur. I'm also thinking about Europe, the, trade associations inside Europe, but also for what you said about health and probably health equipment, medication in other sectors, other parts of the world. I'm thinking about the Ebola in Africa, and if NAFTA could have some kind of trade association that provides health equipment and medication in a more favorable way, together with African trade organizations too. That's my question, and I also had, maybe it goes too far, but you were thinking about sugar and the quest to get sugar at a cheaper price. I remember that back in the day, they used to work with Cuba for sugar canes. They had very good and cheap sugar canes, and I don't know how it is now, because this was before. It was in the times of Batista. I was wondering if now NAFTA would be allowed to work with Cuba, or is there still an embargo on that? Because I know they eased up certain sanctions, but I don't know if they would be allowed to work with Cuba and engage them too in Central or, you know, Caribbean America.
Sure. Seems to me several questions linked into that, but let me talk a little bit about the ones that stand out to me. I mean, one of the themes you bring up is this idea, is NAFTA perhaps the start of a broadening and deepening and integrating of free trade agreements more broadly. So CARICOM or Mercosur in South America, might we see, you know, back 20 years ago, there was also talk of a free trade of the Americas, where every country in the Western Hemisphere would form a free trade agreement. And that dream of many really died in 2004, 2005, when we seen different tendencies and some countries pull away from this free trade model within the Western Hemisphere. You know, in many ways, TPP, or we haven't talked about it yet, but the Pacific Alliance, which was founded by Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile, are an attempt to begin doing that again, sort of a coalition of the willing. Which countries want to face the 21st century and globalization by forming free trade agreements and really opening up their economies to competition with the hope that then they too will be able to compete broadly and export to the world, even as they're more open to imports. So whether a successful TPP negotiation would spur more of this consolidation and of the various regional agreements or smaller agreements that are out there remains to be seen. But I think people, particularly like Robert Zoellick, who I worked with on this task force, who's a big supporter of these types of things, I think they hope that would happen. But I think there's a lot of politics. So that's a sort of remain to be seen. The other issue you bring up is Ebola is a quite fascinating one. And quite tragic, obviously, as we all know. But how that fits in. And so there's one question of how does Ebola fit into North America? We've seen, as we all know, cases here in the United States. I was in Mexico a couple weeks ago, and there's significant worry among the administration there of how they will deal with it. They're preparing, but access to equipment and protective gear and the like is a challenge for many countries. You bring up Africa, but it's a challenge for many countries around the world. So, and one of the issues for North America here on these health issues is how tied we are. And so populations move back and forth, whether through families or trade or other means. And so a pandemic on one side of the border will quickly go to the other sides of these various borders. So how we think about protecting ourselves in general. And then the last thing I would just say, if there's at all a very small silver lining in Ebola, is that it seems as if it's changing or has the potential to change U.S.-Cuba relations in many ways. And some of the most valiant people on the front lines in fighting Ebola in Africa and elsewhere have been Cuban doctors and nurses. And the United States actually has been quite supportive of them and is actually sending protective equipment through our U.S. military to service or to help support these Cuban healthcare workers who are out there in many countries trying to stop this deadly disease. So this is an area where the United States and Cuba are cooperating in a really unprecedented way.
Shannon, well, I'm sorry to say that we are out of time, but we really do appreciate your taking this hour to give us your analysis and insights, and we look forward to continuing to follow your work. I hope, as I said at the outset, that you will all follow Shannon on Twitter at Shannon K. O'Neill, just watch the work that she's producing. So thank you, Shannon.
Thank you all. Pleasure to be with you.
Our next call will be on Thursday, November 20th. Elizabeth Economy, CFR CV Star Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies, will talk about U.S.-China relations. In the meantime, you can also follow us, our academic outreach initiative, on Twitter at @CFR_academic, and there we release new information on CFR resources and upcoming events. So I hope that you will join us there and tweet away. So thank you again, everybody, and we look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.